Everybody can hear me? Great. Hi, thanks for having me here. Everybody in this country knows how good an event this is, so you're very lucky to have us here every Monday. Wow. So I'm going to read mainly from my new book, Heat Signature. The title, I guess, is about a certain kind of heat that I'm looking for in a poem. And I might dovetail back a couple of times to the previous one, Crosstalk, which is pretty cross. But you'll get a sense of what I'm up to pretty, pretty quickly. So I was thinking about the traditional, if there is such a thing, the traditional Irish poem. And I was thinking about, you know, how it's so much more fun sometimes to do the wrong thing rather than the right thing. Weeding. When you weed a field, bend over the long root suckers, the weeders moving in a line across the ridges, a stippled human stripe of inclined heads against the ordered rippling rows of mangoes, then the world seems right and we are in our place. When you refuse to weed and hang out with a friend under the dripping willow in the bend that is not ploughed, where no grass grows over the stones and what is buried, you watch the workers easing themselves tonight. Its shadow keeps ahead of them as they cross. Then you might think of sacrifice or the greater good, but you don't, flirting with heat as heat leaves the day. And you separate, seeing things anew, filthy with possibility. It's too late now to join the weeding crew, and the willow laughs its long, thin laugh at you. And this should be exhausted if you clap after one, so don't feel you have to. So I was doing some work with a pretty famous British poet who just did not get me at all. And I was trying to, I suppose, explain to him that you can be serious and playful at the same time. talk to me later. I haven't sent it to him, but I think he probably gets the message. So I wrote this for him. Tone says, here is the other cheek. Why don't you have a go at that? Tone is when you're giggling at a double bluff and you see someone crying. Tone is an artist dropping a Ming vase and calling that art. Tone is another artist slashing that guy's canvas, calling him a fart. Tone is muscling up to the peace people. They don't have a mandate for peace. Tone sings a satanic mass in the civic center, for Tone agrees to use vinegar for urine. Tone is an author in search of a character able to roll Tone home from the bank. Tone wants a reader in tune with the Tone that is there and the one that is not. Tone is peeling an orange in its pocket so the smell will madden, building a bungalow on your eyelid with an overlook to the back. Tone is a weasel, drawing the birds down with a special sensuous dance, and then Tone is lunch. Nothing trumps Tone, but when there's a crack in it, watch what slips in. It might be an antitone, undoing bravura, dulling the gloss, leaving Tone spent in a fierce bad mood, exposed in the light of all that we once thought we shared. So So I grew up crossing over a back border, hence crosstalk partly. My father was from Warren Point, County Down, and came with a lot of baggage. So I had to try and think things through in a way separately. And I suppose as a poet, you try and you think about how to address, you know, our recent past on this island, but make art somehow or other out of it. So this is Warren Point. Warren Point. I was born after the event. In the undergrowth, we ate licorice leaves, blackened our tongues so we could say bad words like cunt. We talked to the bogeyman who lived in the wood. He went hatless and hunching to the convent door every day save Friday when they dipped fish. The roads ended in hills where the world began. When the sun went down, it lit up other people's lives. If we wanted a goose, we went to the goose farm, chased them until they were solid with fear. In the summer, we swapped nest eggs. That we laughed was no guarantee of hatching. We played soccer in a field flattened out of a hill. Our balls scuppered on pricks of thistle down. Exponential was a word I learned from the radio, bringing the maimings close. Our attics linked up if you wall crawled through. From the last window, we could watch the street unreal. I suppose in the slightly same vein, thinking about the 1916 commemorations, I'm tending to come at things at a tangent, but also thinking about my father and deeply held sort of beliefs and aspirations in a sense. I wrote this called Periwinkles, but then I sort of invited Paul Muldoon and Louis MacNeice and De Valera into the poem as well. So it's a little bit crowded, but anyway. Periwinkles. Long after pollution was confirmed, you insisted on picking periwinkles by the bull wall. We swapped them in the kitchen for fresh ones from Thomas's fish stall in Mary Street. And when you went out door to door for Fianna Fáil, they thought your northern accent helped to swell the brand of softer nation they were selling. Dev had been betrayed, and those treaty chaps were led astray, forgetting the sacrifice of the 16. The inheritance was clear, a straight line back from there to here, and a daughter who believed not one word of it, until you took her up, gave her the tether tour, backing around Stranmillis to Malone. That's where Muldoon slipped out a window of a night to meet his squeeze. And there's the bay those giant roses set alight. So I was talking to Paul earlier about political poetry, and of course every poem, as far as I'm concerned, is political. Having a breakfast is political. So I was pleased when this ended up in the Magma issue on violence. Magma, if you don't know it, is a good magazine. You can read a lot of it online. And it's edited, something like the rotating MC here, is edited by different editors every issue. So it's not stuck in a rut of a particular viewpoint. So it's worth having a check if you don't already know it. So I wrote this. I've had some pushback about it, but still happy about having gone to this subject. How do we address these subjects? This is the question. Interference. I'm on a caffeine high. And on the street and on the steps and in the crowded train, everybody seems their loveliest. Their best selves, hauled out of beds, scrubbed, finished with a comb, moisture still glistening in their pores. I could hug them all, and I'm one of them, all business this day, with work to go to and a bag full of scripts to mark. My coffee is the free one you get after eight others, and the barista says regular skinny cappuccino, and it tastes all the smoother from someone who could have been a friend, judging from her sparkly shoulders. Announcement. Southern Rail is delayed due to a person under train. Briefly, with a smidgen of doubt, I see the brain opened by speed, the steel cauliflower sliced before the blood. But then a tiny infant in a blue suit smiles half at me, and I catch his eye, and we play peekaboo around my cup. Could this be a church, really, right here on the morning train? Could this be church? And thank God for that beyond which there is no appeal, for the bean growers and the harvesters, the roasters and the drivers that bring this treasure from Colombia, certain other cargoes in their slip-sided vents, the middlemen and women, all just trying to raise their kids and give them an education, except those that are not. And I think of the last time I was in church, before the cardinal said that it was right in canon law for that priest to do nothing after children were raped except tell his superior. Tell his superior and skip back to the sacristy to get sacramental. It was right in canon law. And it's clear that law is not what these lovelies want, nor what I want, nor what the dote in the blue suit wants. How can they not see that we are holy? Is it that holding things in place long enough to enter your pores renders a question that halves itself on the way from right to left brain and halves again on until it's in so many pieces you can hardly bear to keep them, but you know it can go on halving? And why did that person, heart scudding, wrist pulsing, walk out under that train this morning? Thanks, I rarely read that, I'm actually going to see now why it's quite difficult. Change the mood, I think. You may have been lucky enough to meet this particular kind of woman. I certainly have. My mother-in-law, who died far too young. This begins with an epigraph from Hugh McDiarmid from The Wreck of the Swan. These men are no dreamers. But I've changed the gender. These women are no dreamers. They make happen the full wake, the kettle hopping, the oven warm. They take death in hand and force him to be civil. In their lighting, the spitting candle calms, and the rosary settles out of irony. These women are not kind. If you do not iron the sheets you borrowed, if you bring batch instead of sliced, what good is that for sandwiches? These women bar all holes in the screamed stall of the birth room. Instead, they ask for the gummed grit they found for themselves in that most alone of coupled moments. These women know how to mash potatoes so that they charge despair out of a teenager. They have followed a father and a small child on a combine harvester not to pick up the pieces of the boy's arm and bring them to his mother, but because they felt the coal of the backfield like something rotting in the feed shed before Chief Rat jumps out. These women will not pass through the horse meadow, even on a summer night, for there they have felt that the world might let us go. They've seen the consequence of that. Ironing keeps it at bay, and doing what is right. So while we're detouring back, I thought I'd read you a poem that is one of those poems that takes off on you. You don't know that's going to happen, but it's been in several anthologies. Not anthologies endorsed by Board Folge, mind you, but... Quickthorn. Don't bring Hall into the house at night, or in any month with a red fruit in season, or when starlings bank against the light, don't bring Hall in. Don't give me reason to think you have hidden Hall about you, tucked in secret, may its thorn thwart you, plucked in blossom, powdered by your thumb, I will smell it, for the hum of Hall is long, its hold is low and lilting. If you bring Hall in, I will know you won't be gone to the fairies and their jilting. I will know you want me buried in the deep green field where God knows what is rotting. Mm-hmm. So you can see I have a sort of dark imagination. So having been quite, I suppose, quite dark in some of the previous book, Crosstalk, I did try to think about, you know, how do we write a love poem now in our ironic times? So this is my attempt at a love poem. You can tell me if it is one or not. Mm. Concentration. What are things made of? The scrape of the potty from under the bed would wake the dead. My grandaunt's squat of balance as she aims, hitching a flannel nightdress high enough to miss its faded pinkness. Back into bed lighter, pot pushed under, a yellow fresh smell like a shape in the room. Steam must be rising from both sides beneath us. If we were taken, assumed, we would be ready, be calmed, made holy by the body. Her King Charles spaniels with Venetian glass eyes look on from either end of the mantle, forever apart in painted disdain, making space actual between them. The pride of one is trumped by the wink of the other. When things attract our deep attention, they give back out the stare that we put in. We know this is commitment of relation, and though it seems innocent to say, it is a form of love. You're the most well-behaved audience, I must say. The quality of your listening is actually quite intimidating. No, honestly, it's great.
One wonders where you've read.
So, this is for anyone who's ever milked a cow by hand. Has anyone ever milked a cow by hand?
Yes.
Okay, great. So we're not all dead. Sometimes you think we're all gone. So
we only run the weapon.
No, I think it was a half a hand. It was a half a two there. And of course, I borrowed from Greek mythology, which I spoke about on the radio, the hand in the myth kitty, to use Philip Larkin's phrase. This is a little short one. Flora. The cow is on top of her game. Her haunches fat, her bones rounded. She feels the goddess power of her udder in the mold damp dark of the milking shed. If she stays still, all may be well. If she thinks of the cool absence of horns, feels their undead weight balancing her head, she may contain herself. But if she kicks the bucket at full froth, tips it from the milker's raw red hand, then she begins a hell which gathers heat all through the livelong days without that milk. Mm-hmm. Maybe you have to be there when that bloody bucket gets kicked. So I don't know whether to read you this long one about Uncle Paddy and the man that came from Atlantis, or you could have Clube from the Reek, which is looking down on Clube from Kilpatrick, obviously.
Which would you
like?
The man from Atlantis.
The man from Atlantis. Okay. All right. Thank you. Very decisive. Uncle Paddy and the man from Atlantis. After devotions, Paddy took his stick and wandered down the strand. Seagulls were not caterwauling for once. He could hear the breeze speak in its foreign tones of all the places it had been, but one place was new. Atlantis, the easterly said, using the lip of his cap to articulate. Atlantis, it's west of here, don't you know, and rises in the coil of unset mind. Now it was crawling dusk and the rocks had that shifty shape as they prepared to move in the night. Paddy nubbed the sand with his stick so it should stay just where it was and he could see where he'd been if he looked back. Then he saw the man lolled against a rock on rose in the sun's deplete, his shoes beside him creased with salt as if they'd been a long time drying by the sea. Paddy had never met a traveller who would not tell a tale, even if it took until the end of the pouring night and the barrel was in the dregs so no head came on the pint. He sat beside the man. The day crept off the beach onto the water and tripped its way toward that far horizon. I know you are from Atlantis, he said to the man. I was told as much. Maybe it's that if you speak, you break the spell. He reached a packet of polaments out of his pocket and offered it to the man. They sat and ate through the rest of the mince, Paddy having to suck one of them hard to get it off the tooth that had fallen in, and the man eating his with a daintiness that Paddy hadn't seen since the wedding breakfast of Myrna on the hill. At last, Paddy said, will you tell me your tale? And the man spoke in a rasp and no accent that was ever heard aloud. You can hear it yourself if you look to where your envy lodges like a jeweled ulcer in your gut, to where the memory of lust in its first rush is livid with longing, to where you have hated your own sister because she was your mother's favorite and got to name the pet lamb. Paddy must have closed his eyes with the shock of knowing, for when he opened them, the man was gone, and he would never be able to hear the end of the traveller's tale, though he looked for him through summer and winter, and especially when the seagulls quietened down and the breeze tipped and whittled at his bones. Well, mainly the UK, and you know, Brexit, we're in the middle of it. And even from here, you know, it starts feeling like Europe will just be that much further away. So it's very odd. So I suppose that was in my mind when I wrote this. And the idea that I certainly didn't, maybe you did, I don't know, grow up doing all the kissing and hugging like that we do now. You know, oh, hello, kiss, kiss, kiss. And I guess that came in with Europe. But is it going to go out? So this is a little jaundiced piece, which is my want, I suppose you could say. Why islanders don't kiss hello. Why islanders don't kiss hello. And it's not just the bad timing, nose grazing, jaw against pursed expectation. Nor is it because of Judas, though he slips out the side door of this discussion. But more that it seems too familiar, as we have not been to preschool with your mother. Perhaps we are not fully of the Europe where the lean-to nature of a kiss can denote who will be shafted in a vote. Or is it just a fear of being wrong? Two in Paris, three in Zagreb, and so on. Right, left, instead of left, right, could affect the funding for those new roads in Cavan. It's not to do with hygiene. We shake hands happily instead, but we've learned because we must, being from the island of largesse, to give that peck of venture in a shared future, where the view over one shoulder is as good from this side as the other. So thinking about Europe. So I'll just finish with two pieces, which has our own little mood. Oh well, before I finish with two pieces, actually, how are we doing for time, by the way? Never took a time.
It's 11 o'clock.
It's 11 o'clock now.
Oh, yeah.
So yes, you can gather that I write sometimes about cows. So then I thought, well, I should do a poem called about cows. But the minute you do a poem about something, it just veers off all sorts of other places. About cows. They shit a lot. And at first it is a warm pat ridged with raised circles as it dries. Water stopped in its tracks, or a viscous jelly hardening from the outside in. I think of dying in a pool of shite, the one my mother meant. Go take a running leap in the slurry pit for all I care. We had lost three cats that summer. Seeing them stiffed, legs rigid and shining, made an art of death. But this was to be about cows, their lumbering walk to the gap to be milked, as if they know more together than apart. They can smell a stream of fresh water from a mile. They can hear grass growing under the bull. They hold time in their four stomachs, chewing it down to the evening milking, feeling the hours move on through. They do not miss the calves they have had taken. No attachment is apparent in 3 days. Perhaps, like the farmer, in a unit of money, they count on exchange. Cows know their own patch, but they'll stray to graze another's. Swung towards the hedge in rain, head stripping, tail swatch, taking a rest from flies. Apparently rural, but worldly wise, cows know that loss is our only measure, expellation, a passing pleasure. So I'll finish it up. Thanks a million. I'll finish up this piece, which I tend to think of as, you know, like a stay against the awfulness. just trying to carve out and hang on to a place for the imagination. And God, don't we need it. So you've been great. Thanks a million, and I'll end with this. I was born in a will-o'-the-wisp, came like a twist of the wise to rouse and sunder. I am the seer you keep at bay, the shadow over your eye. My might is my slightness, my strength is my veil. The way I catch your wish for the real, with my curling truth on your fingers and toes in the whorl of your ear. The conjure of honor, the vision of tribute, I'm there. They think we're a light that breeds in the ghosting fields to darken the tree-held night. But we're not. We're a smolder, ash with a center of roar. We bide our time while you grow in debt and get older. When they gather in halls that are named for the money, and they call for our end and muster an army against what might happen if they upped and entered us, then we are scared, especially of the dismantlers. They do it so well. So fast it's the trick of conjuring mill. You don't see what is gone. Was there nothing there? When one of you names us and knows our intention, we draw you into our inkling lair, the other dimension, and we sing together the song of no nation that will prink and spindle the future of wish, the future of wisp at the center of will. I was born in a will-o'-the-wisp, and I live here still. Thank you.